Now we are going to talk about the key idea of ordination. And in order to do that, we ask this question: what did it mean? What does it mean? And what did it mean then? And how did it evolve? And it did evolve. And so I think it's important to understand that. So I have here four words that are related. The first two are Latin and the other two are Greek. And I'd like to focus first on the two Greek words, hierothesia and hierotonia, both of them meaning simply laying on of hands. And in the earliest references, those are the kinds of words that are used. And for example, in Acts 8:18, this is the story of Simon wanting to get the same power that the apostles had, and he asked them to do it. It's the power of laying on of hands, and he offers money for it. See, so the apostles lay on hands on people. In this case, it's healing. And he wants to have the same thing. So the reference is to the gesture of laying on of hands. And it can be for healing. There are other times when it is healing. In Mark 6:5, in fact, it says that Jesus healed by doing that, by laying on hands. It's the, you might say it's the power of touch there, of healing touch. There's a whole kind of ministry that's called healing touch. The human contact. Also in James, the letter of James 5:14, it says, if anyone is sick, let the presbyters come in and lay hands on them. So this is the power of healing through doing that. But it also is the designation for leadership. It becomes the symbol for that. And 2 Timothy 1:6 is an example of that, where Paul says, remember the gift of the Spirit that was given to you with the laying on of my hands. So it's delegation for something, for leadership in this case. Now, let's go back to the two Latin words, ordo and ordinare, because they really come into a different idea. An ordo, it's a rank, it's an order, it's some kind of organizational principle. And in fact, it had a very specific meaning in ancient Roman culture, and that was belonging to certain social levels, certain social ranks, the upper ranks. It was the ordo of the senatorial class and the ordo of the equestrian class. That's the origin of the words in Latin. So it's a very different idea from laying on of hands. Okay? And that idea became extended into other uses, and particularly in Christian use. For example, Tertullian in the second century, we'll talk about the order of widows, the order of virgins, the order of presbyters. So he is now extending, and he's not the only one, extending this idea that originally referred to the upper classes of Roman society. He's extending it now into understanding of designated groups. And ordinare, the Latin, was to designate someone to belong to that group by the laying on of hands. But the idea of the laying on of hands is not involved in the meaning, the original meaning and developed meaning of the Latin term. So we have here two different ideas that come together to produce this idea of ordination. And it is certainly an idea that took a while to develop into something that we would recognize as ordination. In the earliest period, it probably Was there an actual ritual of laying on of hands? We're not sure about that. But it was a human and a social designation. Other people did it. Parents did it for children, probably. It was a way of affirming and in some cases delegating to a task. We have references to the First Timothy passage that I just told you about, the healing gesture, and when in Acts it says that the apostles appointed presbyters in every city. We'll talk about later what a presbyter is. That may have been with laying on of hands. So it's a gesture that was already there in society, and so they probably appropriated it in these contexts. And it's a designation for leadership. Now, you have to look at this in a developmental sense, because leadership, we've already looked at many aspects of that, what was involved in leadership in a community. Certainly responsibility of some kind. Probably the persons who were designated as leaders in the first generation were also people who could exercise patronage, people who would be patrons, who would give hospitality in their homes, etc. Leadership is one thing. Teaching is another, and I want to say something about that for a moment. It was not necessarily true, I think, in the first generations that the best teachers were the ones who were appointed as leaders. I think the ones appointed as leaders were people who had certainly the gift of relationship, but also of organization. And as I said, people who were in a social situation in which they could exercise patronage, they could be patrons. Now, that person might not necessarily be the best teacher. I think that would be a different function that was exercised differently. Later on, as the church developed and got more organized, they tried to put the two together. And by the time you get to later of choosing bishops, the bishop is supposed to be the person who can organize things, but also is the teacher. And the role of teacher and leader is combined, but that's a little bit later. So in the very first generations, I think what was going on was, as I said, that they look for someone who can exercise patronage, who can be a good patron for the community, and that is the person who is designated as leader. Also, of course, someone who has the ability to form relationships, to stay in them, to inspire the community as well. But that there would be other people and even readers. We've talked about how difficult it was to read a text. So reading was a separate skill. And so probably that was somebody who was well-educated and had the ability to read and interpret text. And then teachers. Remember, we also had prophets, people who were recognized as prophets. And they wouldn't necessarily be the people who were leaders at all, and hands were not laid on prophets. Prophets were not ordained. The Holy Spirit decided who was going to be a prophet. And the way prophecy usually functions in a community, it's really better if the prophet is not somebody who is responsible for the community, because that weighs the prophet down. The prophet should be free to inspire and challenge. So when we talk about leadership, it's not only one person or one function. There are all kinds of different leaders. Remember, Paul in 1 Corinthians 12:28 says, God has established in the church first apostles, second prophets, and third teachers. And he numbers them, first, second, and third, like that. And I've always pondered what he means by that, why there's this numerical order. And I think the I think what he means is that apostles are the founders of the church. Apostles are not people who stay around. You know, they're itinerant. They found the churches and then they leave. Then you've got the prophets, and the prophets are people who are not the best organizers usually. But the teachers, then the teachers are the people who solidly continue the formation of the community. But it's very interesting that he doesn't say there anything about ordination. He doesn't say anything about laying on of hands. He doesn't say anything about who's really the leader here. And I think that's probably understood, that the people who can supply the patronage in all the senses that we've talked about, those are the people they would look to as designated leaders. And to the extent that that gesture of laying on of hands was used, that's where it would be done, you see. Now, we've talked about leadership and coordination. We haven't talked about mediation of the sacred. And what I mean by that is patronage with God. The people who are recognized as having the best connections with God, the ones who can stand before God and represent the people. Now, in the very early years of the Christian communities, I don't think this was perceived as something extraordinarily important or necessary. And the reason I say that is because the Christian groups originated in Judaism, and Judaism had the temple until 70 of the first century as the place where sacrifice was done. And there you need the mediation of the sacred. There you need the priest to offer the sacrifice, stand before God, and represent the people in the holy place. But Jews were already meeting in synagogues. They were already meeting in other places away from the temple in which there was no sacrifice done. It was rather the reading of the scriptures and comment on the scriptures. In other words, a word-based service. When Christians began adapting that, they also had the ritual of bread and cup in memory of Jesus, of what he did at the Last Supper. And very early on, there's sacrificial language used about it, but it is not sacrifice in the same way. It's not destruction of an animal or of the elements, you know, other than consuming them, the people consuming them. And so it doesn't have the same sense of what I want to call the sacred as temple worship does. Now, certainly many of the other religions, and certainly civic religion, had temples in which the sacrifice was going on. Let me just back up for a moment and say something about sacrifice. Sacrifice is the substitution of the human person, substitution of something else for the human person who offers the self to God, because that is the best gift. It is the perception that God is so holy that something has to be done to mediate, to keep that connection, and the offering of the self is the best. The second best is human sacrifice in cultures and religion in which human sacrifice is done. That didn't go in Judaism, so what else then? An animal. Or the first fruits of our harvest. How can we get the best thing and offer it solely to God? It's given over completely to God. That's the instinct behind sacrifice. And sacrifice is done in the Jewish temple. We know that. when the temple is destroyed, Judaism doesn't have it either. And Judaism then turns much more deeply, intensely, into the life of the word in the synagogues. Now, Christians, in the meantime, have the memory of the death of Jesus. That's the sacrifice. That's all the sacrifice they need. They don't need to offer animals. They don't need to offer other things and destroy them for God's use, because they have the sacrifice of Jesus. And that is commemorated in the ritual of bread and cup. So when the Christians come together in the first years, they don't need this high sense of the sacred. What Paul basically argues is that the community is sacred. The community is the temple. He even says that, remember, in 1 Corinthians in chapter 1. You are God's temple. You are the holy. The whole community is as holy as the temple. So that's what keeps them going at the beginning. As Christianity progresses, and as the temple is destroyed, and as everybody tries to figure out what is God doing with that, in Christianity there comes the sense of the replacement of Judaism, the replacement of temple. We call this supersessionism. It means that Christians now who are not Jews are claiming all the promises and the covenant and everything that was part of Israel. They're claiming it has come over to them. And this is a problem in terms of Jewish-Christian relations and Jewish-Christian theology. We won't go into that. But it's happening. And therefore, they look to the shape and the form of religion in the temple, and they see that there is no longer a priesthood, a Jewish priesthood, and so they're going to appropriate that idea. And at the same time, the organization of the Christian community is developing into a position where you have one leader who is a bishop, who has presbyters and deacons, and we're going to talk about that later. And the bishop now becomes seen as functioning as a priest, with the priesthood. And so there's a need for the sacred. And this really increases the need to have formal official designation, which we now call ordination, which is the recognition of leadership within a more organized community, and in which there's some consciousness of the appropriation of the whole legacy of the covenant and the temple in Judaism. And ordination becomes the normal way of designating recognized leaders. And what's important there is the word recognized, that that leadership arises from the community. It is the people who recognize, who acclaim the person they want to be their leader, and ordination is the way of designating that. And I just want to say one other thing about this at this point, and that is that when ordination does develop as a formal designation, it's local and permanent. It is that someone is designated out of the community, arises out of the community, designated for leadership, and it's permanent for that place. It is not something that gives you an accreditation that enables you to move around to some other community. It's for this community specifically. Later on, there are going to be developments of that. So the important thing at this point to say is that that leadership within the community arises from the needs of the community. It's not something that is imposed from outside. It's what does our community need, and who can do it, and let's recognize the persons who can do it formally with ordination.